Welcome to episode 21 of All of Your Business. These are the vulnerable, authentic, and unfiltered stories of business owners whose currents raise tides that lift all of our businesses, communities, and dreams. Before we get started, we are proud to announce that All of Your Business podcast has received a 2020 X-Ray Podcast Award presented by X-Ray FM. X-Ray FM, purpose-driven media at 91.1 FM and 107.1 FM, and find them online at xray.fm. On this episode, we're pleased to welcome Raylan Jones of PDX Black Excellence, and now executive producer and host, Michael Jonas.
So thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it. I've really enjoyed seeing the work that you've been doing, and I know that it's definitely different with the pandemic. So can you kind of talk about, what PDX Black Excellence is and stands for, what you were doing pre-pandemic, and then, of course, what had to change post-pandemic?
Yeah, absolutely. So PDX Black Excellence basically stands for the connection of the Black community in Portland. Was started out as a personal connection to be able to, one, link myself with Black Portland, as well as others. Just took a life of its own. Started as a small group chat, really started as a six-person viewing watching party, a Black Panther viewing watching party. I knew six Black people when I moved to Portland for the first 2.5 years. And I was determined to make a cultural experience here for myself that that I could feel a part of. I'm a transplant, I'm from the Bay Area originally, I'm from a melting pot, so I'm accustomed to being around culture, diversity, and coming here was a little different, and being here and establishing a long-term life here was a little different. So the outlook on it, with this being the least diverse population in the country and a major city. And it took a life of its own. We started out with a small group watching a movie, expanded out to a group chat. Group chat capped at about 32, then 100 plus people. And then I said, it has to be a more efficient way to connect people and get more people involved. So let's make an Instagram page. We can share all the other things that are happening in the city that's Black related until we get a website together. And I don't know if that's a good place to stop at or if I should continue going.
I love it. So it sounds like it's an organization that's about meeting up, celebrating Blackness, and potentially doing either cultural things or community related things.
Yeah, so prior to it being an organization as it is now, we started off more so as an events management company, or we put on curated events ourselves, and we promoted events that were Black related in the city to just kind of promote that experience that lives here and exists here in Portland that is maybe unknown to people that aren't from here, or people wanting to learn more about what's happening here in the community on that cultural level. But we also, I guess if I rewind it a bit, from that Black Panther viewing watching party, which was technically PDX Black Excellence first event, though it was just in my living room with six people. It's still a pretty incredible event, don't get me wrong. One of my faves to this day. But it expanded out to a spoken word event in the summer of 2019, which was actually our first event under the business mantle of PDX Black Excellence officially. And we did a Labor Day event, just a celebration of the people that I had met here coming together and just being a diverse pocket in the community. And like I said, it took a life of its own. It was about 70, 80 people. Again, this is pre-pandemic. We weren't violating any Multnomah County rules. Nobody report me, please, and thank you. this is pre-pandemic. Again, 2019, maybe 2018. We've done a few prior. We had probably like 70 plus people in an environment that was conducive to just good times, good vibes, and diversity that you don't really see in Portland. And from that, kind of those few standalone experiences, people were like, well, keep doing more. Keep doing more. And I was like, okay, I'm with it. Let's keep it going. And yeah, and it's grown. So that's pre-pandemic, where it's grown into it was a business kind of event management company, a LLC. Post-pandemic, as we stand now, as you talk about what's transpired, or not post-pandemic, but during the pandemic, the transition from being able to put on events where they're large scale, for instance, right before the shutdown occurred, we had officially launched, we released our website, we were up and going, we did the Black Party, 220 plus people in a room, it was beautiful, it was glorious. We had music, vendors, all this Black experience, all this culture here in Portland that everybody could get a part of, everybody can be at and get the taste of it and experience it. And it went over really, really well. It was a really great experience and opportunity for the city to see us highlighted in a way that you wouldn't typically see in Portland, in my experience. And that went over great. That was our launch pad. And then literally a week later, things shut down. And then we had to change. We had to adjust on the fly because we can no longer put on events, right? Like those days, though we didn't know it at the time, but those days were over, right? These large scale events.
Hopefully for the moment only, because I look forward to parties again.
Yes, as do we. And we'd definitely like to see you out at some of these, Michael, in the future. We're optimistic. We got some changes that just happened, yesterday, yeah, because I don't know when this will be airing, but we're recording on the 21st. Right, so yesterday there's some changes happening.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, but you brought it up earlier. I mean, it was a big day yesterday.
It was a huge day yesterday.
If anything, competence and compassion. What does the election mean to you? I mean, what were you thinking about yesterday?
You know, I'm just ready for the circus to end. This past 4 years has been, it's some crazy stuff in the world. It's some crazy stuff in history, and I've even experienced in my lifetime. Like, I've never been sheltered from any extremes or anything that, that's even transpired. Kind of in the Black Lives Matter, though it's popular now, it's like I grew up living this life, this reality that is now popularized. But it's like, God, we really hit a new low. Like, as America, in my lifetime at least, it was just kind of like, how did we get here? You know, like, really, like, if we're looking ourselves in the mirror and it's like, how did we really get here?
Or the question is, have we always been here? But when you normalize hate, or when you bring things to surface, you see them in action. So I think there is that question of people showing their true colors. But my thing is more of, after 400 years of oppression, how are we still doing this? We're still going back and forth with this. We're still arguing. I mean, there are people who have Confederate flags that are
marching in the Capitol
building. Marching in the Capitol building, which was built by African Americans.
Right. That part. Say it, Michael. Thank you. Thank you for saying that. I'm glad to hear it from not just myself, because I have to be this voice more often than not. It's incredible, especially when you get to populations that are less diverse, least diverse. I don't discriminate by any means. I have friends across the world. I know people of all backgrounds, shapes, sizes, colors, etc. And a lot of time I become this voice of Black, of Black, right? Like, tell me about Black culture, Black history, Black life. Hopefully somebody makes a podcast and I say it one more time and then I'm done with it. Thank you again.
Well, and that's something that, as a white person, it is not, and I'm going to say this to you, it is not your responsibility to teach white people about racism or why they are racist. That is their own responsibility. And so that is absolutely right what you bring up, that Black people not only have to deal with the racism, but they have to deal with telling people about it, answering questions about it, proving that it exists. Like, people don't believe that people are followed in stores or that there's microaggressions or things like that. So that on top of racism,
right?
You know, and there's the systematic part, which I'm sure you know about, like infant mortality rate, doctors not believing black people who are in the hospital, not having access to healthcare. I mean, it go on and on and on. So, I mean, it sounds like you had a little bit of hope yesterday.
Yeah, I'll keep it a buck with you, Michael. I'm not 100% sold, on Joe. I'm an AOC fan, so, I'm looking 4 years ahead personally. But, I'm an anybody but Trumper. I really can't stand that person. I feel like he is the representation of everything that's wrong and everything that's backwards thinking and, honestly, white supremacy, if I'm being 100% sure. Honest. And
no, I want you to be 100%
yeah,
honest.
Yeah, I have these conversations, and some I don't mind, because some I know, depending on your circumstances, there are really just some people that aren't exposed to certain ideas and certain considerations or certain knowledge. Or any history don't tell you everything, that's for sure. I learned American history for 12 straight years, right, K-12, and I don't feel like I really learned American history until I got to college my freshman year and I took African American history. I'm like, this is a whole other side of history that the history books don't even tell you about, right? Or they
or it's a sentence, it's a cute story, and that's it.
Exactly.
It's a cute story about Rosa Parks, and then that's supposed to cover the whole civil rights movement.
Right, blanket. Rosa Parks sat on the bus. Martin Luther King marched. He had a dream.
Also don't teach about, black people who were scientists. It shouldn't have to take like a Hidden Figures, like a Hollywood movie,
right,
to have a child know.
I didn't know myself about the black woman that was responsible for creating GPS or helping with the assistance of GPS. The black woman that was responsible, I think, for the first shuttle or first space launch, or one of them at least. I had no idea, and the fact that, again, you either only get these like glorified versions of what black history is, and then that's supposed to blanket cover it all. It's like, no, in reality, there's a lot of deep-rooted, dark history in this country that, they don't tell you about. We don't acknowledge our past transgressions in America. I don't like to get super, super, but I do feel that in me. So if you see this tattoo in my arm, I know everybody else can't, but Michael, you can. This is a Danish flag for Denmark.
Very cool.
Yeah, and so I was fortunate enough to go live in Denmark when I was in college, when I was wrapping up my undergrad, for about 6 months. And I experienced society and culture and just a different perspective of life that was unbeknownst to me at the time. You can read about things for sure, and you can hear about things, but, I got to live it and see a different way. And what I will say to that, though, is I won't go down that path just yet, unless you put a gun to my head. Please don't, because I do it willingly. But I had good friends in Germany, and I went to go spend, I'll just tell this story. I went to go spend Christmas and New Year's in Germany with my friends. I was there for a week, traveling between this little village near Leipzig and Berlin. So Leipzig village for Christmas, Berlin for New Year's. And while I'm there, I get to uncover these super deep experiences, like my German friends. First and foremost, I want to backtrack and say I wasn't sure how I was going to be perceived in Germany, right? I'm black. I'm thinking, only thing I know about Germany is World War II, Mercedes-Benz, BMW. I'm very ignorant to how I'm going to be able to interact in Germany, right? Will I be ridiculed or, I'll be frowned upon based on the color of my skin? No idea, right? I don't know anything. So I get there, and it's a complete opposite experience. People love me over there. Literally, I'm literally like the LeBron James, the Kevin Hart. you name it. Somebody called me Red Man and Method Man at one point.
Oh, wow.
These are Russian people, too, like authentic Russian people. It was incredible. Like, made my life, actually. And so I'm in Germany. My friends are taking me around to experience German culture and heritage. I go to a concentration camp, and it was one of the deepest, if not the most deepest experience of my life. You can feel it in your body, but they're telling me about all these historical events. I go to Berlin, the Berlin Wall, forget the name of the stop, but I think it's One Stop Charlie or something along those lines. But they're telling me all these historic events that transpired throughout Germany. I'm like, wow, that's crazy. I'm like, yo, if you went to San Francisco, I couldn't tell you a thing. Like, we'd be on the same tourist bus together, you know. And more so, I was like, maybe because we don't have as much history on the West Coast. I'm thinking a lot of the more historical things probably transpired on the East Coast, and maybe that's why I'm not as familiar. But then I'm like, you know what? Still study that American history. I know a couple of landmark things, but I don't really know it like this. Mm-hmm. So as they're telling me all these crazy and tragic events that had transpired, especially during the era of Hitler, right? And Nazi Germany, right? In World War II. They let me know that the reason that they know all these things and why they're very familiar is because in Germany, from the time you're this big, so I'm pointing like down to the ground basically, to the time you're as, you know, big as I am today, which, you know, I stand at a 5 foot solid, 5 foot 10 stature today, I think. I hope. But, you know, until you're, you know, an adult, you know, they embedded in you everything that's transpired because they're ashamed. They're ashamed of what happened. They're ashamed of Hitler. And they want the people, their youth, the people that are coming up to know that this isn't good. What transpired here was not tolerated and it doesn't represent our people. And they don't ever want to have another Hitler be produced again from their country. And I thought that was...
And that's painful, but that's real. And that's what America needs to do.
Absolutely. I thought that was really deep because I'm like, well, we never do that. You know, like last I checked, Texas was trying to even get slavery removed from their history books because, you know, they live in corporate America and the people that sell you the books kind of have some control over the curriculum or what you're able to learn. And, you know, it just, you know, there's a lot of, you know, I guess if I were really looking at America and the capitalistic aspect of it, I guess that really is the hardest part for me because though I think capitalism is healthy in some regard, the way we go about it here kind of makes it a little bit, to some degree, detrimental for the overall betterment of everyone in our mm-hmm. society. But that's where our society, that's what our society is rooted in and what it believes in the most, even though I don't think it believes in everybody else the most the same way that they believe in it. Sure. But, you know, I think that that's one of the major issues. And I think because our country is rooted in these societal values, it's not really willing to look back or acknowledge the indifferences, acknowledge the inequalities, the systemic inequalities, the historical inequalities. It's like we can gloss over those things. Everybody has the same opportunity to get everything. In reality, it's like, that's not true.
Why do you think that is? Is it that people are comfortable with superficial? Is it that white people are worried that they can't deal with someone saying that they may be racist? Because I know that's a big thing, is the moment that you talk about race, someone says, I'm not racist. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what do you think is, like, why don't you think America is good at this? And I know that's a big question.
Yeah, you know, as soon as I get that all the way down, I'm like, write a novel about it and maybe make $1 million and then definitely move away. I think that, in my honest opinion, because I have these conversations, especially I have it with good white people, and I say that because I have a lot of white friends and a lot of people that just don't have the understanding. I think it really boils down to ignorance. Even though I think some of it is a ignorant is bliss kind of compound, because we live in the information age now, right? There's no reason for you to not know anything that you really want to look into and know more about if you really have that desire. But as I talk to people of that background, it's like, it's kind of like you don't know what you don't know. You can't really put yourself in my shoes as a white person, right? Sure. Like you can look at it on the news. You can form whatever thoughts you think you have about my culture, my life, and my society that I live in. But in reality, you just don't know. And I've had so many conversations. I remember when how was his name? Was it the brother Brown that was choked out? He was choked out for selling the Lucy cigarettes.
Was it Eric Garner?
Eric Garner, sorry. Yeah. That's Eric Garner. So many now. I'm just trying.
That's what, I mean, it shouldn't be that way. That there's so many that it's hard to remember.
Right. Not even a long time ago.
Yeah.
You know, it's recent tragic events. But I remember having a conversation with a lady that I worked with at the time, and I'm enraged. I'm so upset. I'm watching this video. I can't believe it. I just can't believe that this was allowed to, you know, this basically public execution was allowed to carry on in the middle of the day in New York, especially for why, you know, it's like this transpired. I mean, there's no justifiable reason for it, but this is over the sale of a loose cigarette, 25 cents, 50 cents. This man lost his life over that.
Well, and that list goes on and on. I mean,
yeah.
Breonna Taylor's in his own home. Ahmaud Arbery is what, on a jog,
right,
in his neighborhood.
Yeah,
the list goes on.
It's absurd. I mean, it's enough to drive a sane person crazy, like myself. It's just a lot, right?
But let me ask you this, because you know, we were talking about the election. One of the most historic things that happened yesterday that I thought was really beautiful and really interesting was, not only did Sonia Sotomayor, the first Latina Supreme Court justice, swear in Kamala Harris as the first woman Southeastern Asian, mm-hmm. and first Black vice president. So there was that.
Mm-hmm.
But that same day, Kamala went to the Senate and she swore in three people. She swore in Alex Padilla for California to replace her. So the first Latino senator of California. And in California, there's 40% now population of Latino people. So they now have a Latin senator. And she swore in John Ossoff, Jewish, and who interned and worked for John Lewis, civil rights icon,
mm-hmm.
and Reverend Warnock, who preaches at Martin Luther King Jr.'s Baptist Church.
Mm-hmm.
So on the same day or in the same month, we have an insurrection on the Capitol with Confederate flags. We have people trying to steal the democracy, steal the results.
Right.
And then that same time frame, we have the most diverse Congress we've ever had.
Right.
And we have, you know, more women in power. I mean, I've been reading too with the Biden administration, you know, and like it, don't like it, be critical. We all need to be critical. That's just a part of life.
Have to.
The fact that like his entire communications team is women.
Yep.
You know, he's appointing an assistant health secretary who's transgender woman. He's appointing people who are black to be in charge of military roles. So I guess my point in this is, how do we deal? We have two nations here, you know? I mean, it's not a civil war in the way that the Civil War was, but in a way it is. We have people who are complicit with racism.
Definitely.
And are not giving into the social contract, which I believe is part of America. And then we have people who are completely against this, and they're either divisive, complicit, okay with hate, fearful that people of other races are going to take what they should have. Like, so I guess how do we bridge that divide? How do we talk to people that don't believe in truth and are spouting conspiracies? How do we talk to people who are normalizing hate? Because that's what's happened, is it's become normalized. And I don't know, I'm just rambling, but no, it was just great. A very thought-provoking thing for me that in the same time frame, we have forward-moving and backward-moving or stagnant all at the same time.
Yeah. First and foremost, I just want to say that's an excellent question, ramble, whatever you want to do.
It's a ramble.
If they got a round of applause button in the middle of this, please hit that now, because I just touched on so many points that topics that are present and persistent in my daily interaction. I mean, I literally was just having a conversation with a friend of mine last night about all of this. Her coming from a conservative background, you know, kind of Bible Belt kind of background, but wanting to understand, and me being on the opposite side of that, right, and coming from a urban city place, diverse place, but discussing to those points, right? I think we're a country divided, and this is what I spoke to. I mean, I think we're a country divided. I think that it's gotten to the point where we've chosen sides based on politics, which is pretty sad. Sad in my opinion, because I don't believe in being an all-inclusive representation of who I am, personally. I believe that we have the wisdom and we were bestowed the knowledge on us, these brains that exist in us, to make decisions that we can say, hey, we can support this, but we can't agree with that. Or maybe some of this feels like our truth, but this isn't, you know? And it just seems like the current climate of this country is you choose a side. And it's sad because I feel like one side does represent this white superiority, this old kind of olden days consideration, for instance, make America great again, right? What does that really stand for? I believe that stands for make America white again, right? Like, what are you referring to? What's different from America now? And like, or what time are you referring to when America was great?
The crazy thing about that is, unless you're Native American, you're either an immigrant or you're a child of immigrants.
Exactly.
So everybody in America, you know, besides Native Americans are immigrants.
Exactly.
And whether their family came through Ellis Island or, you know, whatever it was.
Right.
This idea that there's this white purity. I mean, yeah, it goes back to Manifest Destiny and, you know, it's this sort of thing of like, I'm all powerful. I can't give to people who may take power over me. But I think all of that's ludicrous, because not only have Black people, you know, fought for America, like both in the Civil War and then in other wars, they, as we mentioned earlier at the podcast, they helped build America.
Yeah.
And so my thing is, yes, there are two views and two Americas, but it's almost like you're either American. And this is funny, too, because these are people who question patriotism and America and all that. To me, if you're American, you're giving into that social contract of diversity, and you're anti-American if you're not. Right. And so somehow that message got twisted that they're true patriots by acting the way that they are.
Yeah.
And the other issue that I have is you know, you can be conservative, right? Like, you can have conservative principles. You know, environmentalism is actually a conservative principle. Republicans are the ones who did Federal Reserve lands. And to me, the most godly thing you can do is helping the environment. You can have conservative values, family values. The idea that treating women as less or paying them less or not welcoming people in the country, the idea that all these things that have been happening are somehow okay or somehow American or somehow conservative values,
yeah,
is odd to me. Or not odd, but, and a lot of the people who are elected in office, they know better.
Yeah.
And they're emboldening hate and spreading conspiracy theories and telling people that it's okay to be violent.
Right.
And they're also ignoring calls for social justice.
Right.
Or labeling them. You know, I remember they said even Portland, like, we're, you know, an anarchist town, or we're, they call it like a, you know, these Black Lives Matter mob.
Right. I saw that on the news.
You're a mob because you're asking to be treated with equal respect and dignity and to have the rights of everyone else, you know. But then if you're at a Trump rally,
you're a patriot
with guns and motorcycles. We had a Trump rally here in Clackamas County where people were in large trucks holding guns, literally open and carrying, driving all around town with large guns. Not one of those people was shot at, was stopped. You know, and same thing with the Capitol. Right. Had it been a Black man or homeless person or whoever who tried to breach the Capitol,
right,
they would have been shot at.
Absolutely.
But instead, they, you know, there were selfies being taken.
Right. Doors being opened. And that's what I tell people. If you really don't believe in inequality and that there aren't really any indifferences because of who you are, I'm like, you could just take a look at these parallels. You take a look at these aggressive mob-like mentalities, these patriots, right? What they're doing is justifiable. This is America. We're taking back America. When Black Lives Matter, peaceful protests, for the most part, are going down the streets, really championing the fact that we are being murdered out here unjustifiably, and we're fighting for our lives. We're literally fighting for our lives. And you consider this more detrimental, more of a a target or a, you know, a negative reflection of American society. When you can't see that these two things are completely different, but they exist right here at the same time, like, I feel like you either don't want to accept the truth, the reality of the situation, or you just, I don't know, it's just, it's again one of those kind of ignorance is bliss sitting right there looking at you, but you just can't see it. And I don't know what that is, but I wanted to touch base back on what you had said a little bit before. And it was just that, you know, when we're looking at these two sides and we're looking at divider, right, and you're talking about all of these different things that are happening, women being in office, Hispanics being elected, right? And I say that to say, because I see that as well, but I look at, where are these parties that are welcoming and accepting diversity? What party is kind of known for that more so, and what party is, you know, known for the opposite of that, right? And that's why I feel like there's this divide, where there's really this line divide. There's like everything else that represents diversity, diversity inclusion, you know, whether that be women, people of color, supporter of the lower class to the classes that aren't the superior upper class. And then there's a party that, you know, I'm not saying all inclusive, nothing's all inclusive, right? But then there's this party that adopts this other kind of way of thinking, that is this, well, you know, we're white, we don't want to support people that can't support themselves. We don't care about accepting others. And I just think that if you can look at that right there alone and see that half of the alignment is with diversity and the other half is with the least amount of diversity, you can kind of see where we're clashing and where we're coming to this divide at, right?
It's, well, and don't tell that to, you know, gays or blacks or Latinos for Trump.
Oh, yeah. Because
they actually exist.
I know. Sadly. Sadly.
But the thing, you know, the thing with racism, too, is there should be people who stand up and who find fault with it. So it's not enough to just be like, I'm putting out a BLM statement, or I am telling you I'm not racist. So when you talk about elected officials, where are all the people who stood up and had a problem? They didn't have a problem with anything. They didn't have a problem with shithole countries, kids in cages, the Muslim ban, the wall. I mean, the list just goes on and on.
Right.
Murders of black people. And so, you know, and there's this sort of like, we say it in a funny, ironic way, like thoughts and prayers, you know, because we don't need that. We need systematic change.
Absolutely.
And we need structural change. And so that is digging deep, like the thing that you were talking about. That is looking at everything, the prison industrial complex, the education system, job markets, and how people are hired, how people are admitted to colleges. I mean, the list goes on and on.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is it requires a lot of work, and it requires reckoning, and it requires self-reflection. So where people, and I'm making generalizations, but I don't understand how people who are supposedly really religious or really conservative, who love Jesus or love God, how they believe that who they are and what they believe in aligns with how they act.
Right.
So, you know, I look at someone like Donald Trump, and we don't want to talk too much about him because, you know,
he's gone.
But he as a person is gone.
Sure.
74 million people who were complicit in his behavior are not gone.
Right.
And so how do these people who tout religion or tout that they're good Judeo-Christian people act in this way? act threatening, act violent, not love thy neighbor,
right?
Not accept refugees or immigrants. So where is that disconnect? That's I mean, is it that they go to church and a pastor tells them that they should tell their Mexican neighbor to deport themselves?
You know,
like,
right.
Like, where are they getting? I mean, is it Fox News? Is it Facebook? Like, where are they getting this information?
You know, you're going to get me in trouble because I literally have these conversations all the time. I don't know where that disconnect is. I say it all the time that I feel like the hypocrisy in church specifically, right? In the reflection of what we stand for as a people and what we're trying to accomplish in terms of our hierarchy and our beliefs, they don't align with your actions, right? Like, I don't see it happen from a lot of, you know, and I'm gonna just say, like, the Christians that, you know, act in the way that they carry on, and it's, you're supposed to carry on in this kind of treat thou neighbor, or like be fair and be kind and have remorse and empathy and things of that nature, and that's what you're taught. But where is
you mean Jesus doesn't say, like, you're out of your healthcare premium, you can die,
right? You know, and it's like, where is that consideration? And when it's applied to real life considerations, right? Like, when it's applied to all these things that you just mentioned, I mean, I don't know what the disconnect is. I practice Buddhism. I study world religions personally, and I found that for my walk in life, I thought, you know, just to define my path and how I want to navigate through the world, Buddhism suited me best. But when I have these conversations, and I have many, you know, I really just feel like a lot of it comes back to, again, ignorance and not understanding. Getting all your information from one source, from one perspective, doesn't allow you to see the full picture, right? It's like you're only getting this sliver of the pie, but you always reinforce your values. Like you said, if I'm scrolling, if I'm on my social media or my Instagram, I watched that Social Dilemma, which is, I thought was very interesting. But if I'm scrolling on these things, right, I'm not looking for things that are indifferent from my beliefs and my thoughts. You know, I'm choosing things that align, that reflect with my own beliefs and what I consider. And then it just reinforces, then you just get this constant reinforcement until it becomes like the truth. Mm-hmm. It becomes your Bible. It becomes your scripture, like what you truly believe in. And I guess it's sad in that regard, because I feel like it's this programming that if you can't break free from it, if you're not allowed to, if everything, if all the interactions you have, if every person that you've ever grown up, your environment, all the hierarchies that you consider, whether it be, you know, close friends and family or role models or however you look at it, if they're all projecting to you this one message, and that's the only message that you're able to see and believe, then how can you even rationalize or comprehend any other belief, right?
Sure. It's like, yeah, it sounds like you're bringing up a really good point about it's kind of like a virtual bubble where people are also in physical bubbles where they decide, I'm going to only live in a white neighborhood, I'm not going to work with black people, I'm not. So it's sort of now people are doing that in all facets of their life, and the dangerous part of that is, and I was just talking to someone about this today, the easiest principle in social psychology is the contact theory, where if you just talk to someone who's different from you, the walls come down. You realize that, you know, not all gay people do cocaine and wear boas and are flamboyant or are drag queens. You realize not all black people are criminals. You know, like, you start meeting people, oh, a woman in power, she is running this business. That blows my mind. Like, if you never have contact with anybody who is different from your view, or you don't read about it and you're not willing to look at other sources, like what you're saying, basically both your virtual world and your in-person world are always going to be you and that bubble that you're creating. And so that's shocking to me, because we're now in 2021. So you would think, like, well, don't people in Texas or California, you know, see people of every race and color and religion and you know, don't they go to school? Don't they, you know, like, you would think that everybody in America at this point would be exposed somehow to people who are different enough to the point where these stereotypes and biases, even if they're works in progress, they would be isolated and reflected upon.
Right.
And the answer is no.
Right.
Because of what you're saying is that there's the choice of limiting yourself. And what I'm talking about is the assumption, it's being too kind. It's making an assumption that when someone realizes, first of all, that they realize that they're biased, and then that they actually want to work on it and they actually want to grow as a person.
Right.
And so the sad thing that I've had to learn as an adult is people don't want to do that. There are people who are not willing to grow.
Right.
There are people in that mob who, even after being arrested, you know, it's everybody else's fault still.
Right.
What if I told you, no, it might be your fault. You might be the variable. Maybe you should reflect upon why you lost your job and why you're arrested by the police and why you were dragged on social media. Maybe it's you.
Right. Some accountability, right?
And so I think that there's that lack of reflectiveness. But the thing that I also thought about yesterday, and it hears me rambling again, was – there is this need for unity, but there is not a need for a toxic positivity washover, which is to just be like, oh, we're not, you know, now we're gonna solve the pandemic and racism is gonna be gone and all that. So there, and I don't think that that's what this administration's doing, but there's gotta be this sort of reality that this is gonna take time, this is gonna take pain, this is gonna take people talking about everything from slavery to reparations to even post-slavery. Okay, people believe that once slaves were freed, slaves were freed. No, they were not.
Right.
You know, some didn't even find out that they were free, and then some were promised 40 acres and a mule. They never got that.
Right.
Like, it, the pain goes on for hundreds and hundreds of years. So,
well, Michael, my question would be, when is it going to start to happen? When is it going to start to occur? Of course, it's going to take a long time, but we have to start. Like, where we're at right now is reminiscent of pre-civil rights movement, right? Or the civil rights movement era, right? Like, you would think, why does my lifetime that I'm currently living in reflect my parents,
sure,
or the generations that came before me, right? How can we still be in the same point or the same standstill, stagnant? Like you said earlier, it's like, have we really changed? Has it always been America?
After having a black family in the White House?
Right.
Well, after having, you know, Colin Powell, after having, you know, like, leaders across the board who are black.
Yeah.
You would think that, and people in their community, I mean, there are people who are racist at their community, and there's a black doctor who is the head of the hospital in their town, and right, that still hasn't in their mind somehow registered that people are people, and this is someone who worked hard in a merit society where you rise if you do good things. So I struggle with, and I'll tell you, this is really personal to me. I mean, not in the same way, in a different way. I'm not black. I don't know what it is to live black, to be black, but I have a boyfriend, and you know, my mom, and I have tons of black friends and immigrant friends and friends of every religion, and my mom and my dad voted for Trump, and my mom, you know, doesn't really want to talk about it, but I've told her, okay, this isn't just an opinion. In her mind, it's just an opinion. But it is not just an opinion. It is voting, or it was voting, against rights. So this relates back to, we have to get people in America to realize it's not just about them. This is a collective nation, and this is a social contract. So when you make a decision about something, even if you're not black, you can still do something that's kind and just and right. If you're not gay, you can still do something that's kind and just and right. The idea that I'm white and my rights are not on the table, so I don't really care, or I'm forced to explain, or you're forced to explain to the other person who can't realize the hurt that they may have caused, and they're not willing to meet you in the middle or to figure out in a reflective way why that vote could have affected. That's the issue we have, and that's kind of my worry, is are the people, if we're willing, you and I and other people, willing to cross over and ask them, you know, for unity, are they willing to be reflective about the pain that they may have caused? And are they willing to be reflective enough to grow?
Yeah.
And if they're not, then how do we deal with that?
Yeah, and that's hard, because there is a lot of defense to that, right? It's hard, like you said, to tell somebody, hey, you know, the way you've gone about things or some of the considerations that you align with are racist, or they're detrimental to people that don't look like you, people of black and brown or descent, right? I had a hard conversation with a close friend of mine, you know, and a Trump supporter. I try not to have these conversations anymore because I get really worked up about it. But, you know, it got to the point where it was like, you know, I don't want to hear this. I'm not going to apologize because my skin is white and I'm from where I'm from, and you're born skin that you're born. You're from where you're from. And it was just like, you're so reluctant. You're literally so reluctant to acknowledge anything that goes against, you know, your way of thinking or your capacity to handle like this criticism, not even a criticism, this kind of truth, right? This openness. And it's like, you know, a lot of people don't want to hear what they don't want to hear, right? Like, if you know, some people are open-minded and it's an easy conversation for them to have. And it's like, okay, let me digest this new information that I didn't previously know, yeah, or consider, but it's real. It at least has some logic or some base, some foundation to it. And a lot of people are saying, no, you know what? that's too hard for me to digest. Yeah. That's too much for me to consider.
But here's the other thing. The other thing along those lines is it becomes about them. It becomes about them feeling uncomfortable because you're saying that they may have done something racist.
Right.
What about you or the person who the racism was done against? We end up educating and helping and comforting and talking more to the person who believes that they were unjustly accused of being racist. And then the person who is the person who is hurt isn't even heard. So
yeah,
what if I told you that the reaction should be that we stop and we say to the person, are you okay? So I think that's another part of it is white people, and again, I'm generalizing, I don't speak for all the white people. I mean, white people can get so caught up in their own defense or talking or this or that, that if you really do care, the first thing you would do is want to know if the person who you were racist against is hurt by what you said.
Sure.
And ask them how you can learn from that experience or what would... So that's...
Well, then you would have to accept that you have been wrong, or you wronged somebody, or you've done wrong, or maybe our ancestry is wrong. But you have to... First, you have to embrace that idea.
And why can't people do that?
I don't know. I mean, it's... Yeah. But you know what? I'm going to tell you one thing, Michael, while you're here. This top secret. You know, it's between me and you. Don't let anybody know. But I have an idea, because I've had a lot of these kind of considerations and these questions, especially when it comes to, you know, Black America and Black culture and Black people. You know, I've seen it, I've heard it go growing up, like, go back where you come from, you know what I mean? Like, we all aren't immigrants, you know what I mean? And like, we weren't forcefully here, and that the great country as we know it on an economical level, as America as we know it today, doesn't exist the way it exists because of, you know, free labor, cotton, you know, that industrial industry or however you want to post, but because of Black labor, right? So my brilliant idea that I wanted to do, I actually talked to a friend of mine. She's ahead of a TV studio now in LA. Shout out Nicole. I'm going to give her one shout out real quick. She's probably like, yeah, right, we did talk about that. But what I want to do is like this either docuseries, maybe a little docuseries or this little movie or something, and it'd be like America without Black people. And I think it would just be a eye-opening kind of like introspective reality, yeah, about what America looks like to the person that isn't willing to digest me just telling you that Black people have done this and what we're meaningful for and why you have to acknowledge some of the transgressions that have occurred in this country. But obviously we can't go too far back. We have to literally look at like almost modern day America without Black people, because if you just take Black people away from the equation,
you would be there all day. But I think it's great. But you know, you have the plow. So like the plow for farming, the modern day plow was invented by Black people.
Well,
you have all, you know, that whole section of music, like all the blues, jazz.
I'm saying,
oh, it's all gone.
That's what I'm saying. I'm like, I was first like, if we went all the way back, like to slavery, then America just isn't the America that we know it today, right? Like the White House isn't built, you know, or some white people had to build the White House. I don't know how that's gonna go. Saying get out there and just perform and produce all day long, regardless of the conditions, and you know, slavery.
I think it's a great idea.
I do too.
I think it's sad that that has to be something that's done. But I do think it's a great idea. And there was a similar project that was, I think it was like Day in a Life Without an Immigrant or Without a Mexican,
Like
that.
Yeah, like without the babysitting and like the labor, some of those.
I think that that should be done. And I think that people need to realize that it's not, it's also that there are histories of cultures, like individual histories. But what people need to realize is that there is a multicultural shared history. The history of America is a history with Black people.
Well, yeah, you can't have American history without Black history. Like you said, even if you touch back on pop culture as it stands today, I mean, in my opinion, Black people are the most influential people in the entire world, let alone the country. Black people from America create so many trends. Like, think how boring America be. Boring as fuck.
I was thinking the same thing.
America be, you said it, yeah, so boring without the influence of Black people.
The food,
right,
would be bland as well.
I mean, what is American food if we're not talking about Black food? Like, if we're not talking about some fried chicken or some Southern food, what do we really got? We got maybe hamburgers, you know, hot dogs, brats, that's German, right? Like, so what are we really talking about? We're not talking about Hispanic food, not talking about Italian food, we're not talking about Mexican food, you know, what we're talking about. So American food is just as, you know, Southern food, black food is America's basis to good food, right?
Yeah.
But even besides that, I mean, look at pop culture without music. I mean, people give a lot of credit to some of the, you know, the people that, you know, that are white that took black music, right, and ran with it. But behind most forms of music in America, even country music, which I can't stand, but, you know, even country music has black influence and black, you know.
I don't know why when you said that I thought Darius Rucker.
Yeah, of course. It's always good old Darius Rucker. Yeah. But, you know, it's just if you really remove that from the equation, you think about your everyday life. I mean, look at these TikTok battle, Instagram. What would Instagram or some of these things, social media, the dance battles, just the creativity, the fashion, the swag, the terminology, just a lot of innovation that has occurred, especially on a pop cultural level, right? Which drives some of the industries that we even have here today, even our most thriving industry, the tech industry, right? You look at Silicon Valley, these phones, you know, you know, hand over fist, and a lot of these things.
Yeah, I hear you. And even the people who, like I was just thinking about Etta James, and, you know, we give Etta James credit, but then people don't even know that Etta James didn't own her own music.
Right.
You know, like, even when it was putting people up, we were still taking from them.
Right. Right. I know. It's amazing. And again, they don't teach you that part in history class, right? They don't tell you where Elvis is rooted in, right? He's the king, but what about the people that came before him, or the styles that were originated prior to Elvis that, you know, he gets the credit for, and, you know, the reflection, you know, even if you look at a modern time, right? You can look at it current today. Eminem, for instance, right? To this day, still, Eminem is what, probably the highest selling artist or hip hop artist. Not I used to love Eminem.
Yeah, like, he's the real Slim Shady.
2-3 years, yeah. The last maybe 2 decades, I'm like, I don't know, you know, this is not for me. But, you know, again, Eminem is considered the greatest, most highest selling. You ask, but did Eminem create rap? Is there rappers that even came before Eminem that had similar kind of styles, or which would never have gotten the credit or the shine, the rise? Couldn't even probably go about it the same way as Eminem did back in the time that he went about it, right? You know, that's just, again, to just show you that, you know, a lot of these considerations we have, you know, whether it be from a sports, entertain. I mean, I need to look at sports.
What do you think about, so the funny thing is, this is like night and day with this administration, because the last administration, they were trying to get rid of racial training and government agencies and things like that. Don't get me started on Betsy DeVos either.
Oh,
but
man.
So
education, we could finally it's educate night and day, people.
But do you think that maybe this starts young, and maybe, you know, everybody learns early on black culture, black history in schools? Like, how do we do this on a massive scale?
That's a hard question, because, again, I'm from the Bay Area. I'm from a melting pot, and I grew up around everybody. I saw all walks of life. And in honesty, I didn't know how different the Bay Area was growing up. Like, when I look back about it, you go to the Bay Area, you're just a Bay Area person. Mm-hmm. It really doesn't matter what your skin reflection is. You're a Bay Area person.
Whereas, yeah, you're used to 2-hour traffic time for distance.
I hate it. Oh, don't get me started. That's why I left. But, you know, then I've come here and I've met people that are from towns that didn't even have another person of color in their entire town. Maybe one family that was different. I was like, is that real? That's still, like you said, this is America we still live in. There's places. Yeah. I met a girl once, you know, when I got here. It's not like it was a long time ago. I met a girl. She's like, the first time she met a black person, she was like six. She's like 6 years old, and she was trying to scrub off skin because she thought he was dirty.
Interesting, yeah.
And, you know, and I'm just like, wow, like, so there's people.
Well, and that was a 6-year-old. We still have grown adults who are like, you're the first black person I've met.
I'm saying, and so, and again, if you look back and say, because, you know, this is a truth, in some ways, it's all people form their opinions and their thoughts, because that's all they have to go about. I learned about this in international business, but stereotypes and stigmas are part of a relationship or a reality outlook for people that don't have the opportunity to engage like me and you are currently. So they have to form
these. So if we teach kids the stories of black people in America that represent current American culture, that to me seems like that would be one of the many steps. So, you know, a child who's learning about Thomas Jefferson and George Washington and you know, they're also knowledgeable about Ida B. Wells, and they, you know, they're sort of, they're learning more and more about these stories. So, because as you know, and we mentioned, slavery is sometimes like a sentence.
Right.
And maybe there's negative things about Black people, but what about positive stories, role models,
right,
heroes and heroines?
Yeah, I mean, I'm all for education reform, don't get me wrong. I definitely believe that there should be more emphasis. I think that you should either incorporate all aspects of American history when you have to learn about it, and not just the glorified versions, but I think you should also have the choice to choose, maybe, like, what versions. Like, I thought it was sad that I had to be 18 years old and finally break away from the standardized system of education in America to learn something different about the history of this country, to learn another factual, you know, perspective or presence that exists, that's always existed, but literally my entire life, I was never able to digest that. I didn't go to private school. I'm in public school, you know, all day.
Yeah, tell me more about growing up at Oakland.
Yeah, so I was born in Oakland. I lived in the Bay Area, but we traveled around. My mom, I mean, we're like, our family is located in Oakland, like both sides of my family, my dad and my mom. And we have some really prominent figures, actually, in my family from Oakland. We had an uncle that was on the A's. Both of my grandmothers were just very, like, big figures, pillars in our community. So then I was like, I just kind of like this child that came from these two great families, which is really cool. I didn't look at it that way, but in reflection, it was really cool. But because of that, I was always just exposed to a lot. Like, I was exposed to a lot of good, a lot of, like, people that probably, you know, most people aren't exposed to all the time, diversity situations. But I also grew up in poverty. Like, I mean, like, to some degree, you know, like, we were lower class, you know, my mom spoke to it yesterday, like, being on welfare, you know, and living in a place, you know, at one point we lived for a stint in Vallejo, and, you know, I've seen so many rough sides of the equation, right? You have to grow up fast where I'm from. I've grown up in environments where friends die before they reach the age of 18, right? And, you know, I've grown up in environments where people don't literally leave the city that they're from. So then I understand that there's other points of view that I've been fortunate enough to see that a lot of people don't. But yeah, I mean, I won't say I grew up like, I mean, you have to definitely grow up fast where I'm from. And, you know, some things were harder than others. But I'm thankful for my upbringing, like, regardless of what we had or didn't have, like, I never looked at it that way because I didn't know any other, you know, to really look at it, any other way to look at it or perceive it. So I'm very thankful for that. There were some, you know, some considerations. Like, I ended up moving to Corvallis in high school, Corvallis, Oregon. And prior to that, you know, it was hard for me to move here. When I moved to Corvallis, and I did not want to leave. But in hindsight, I'm thankful it probably saved my life. Like, you know, I come from a place where it's easy to get in trouble, easy to get involved in the wrong things. The high school that I would have went to, the graduation percentage for Black men was less than 10%. Wow. Yeah. So, you know, most of my friends that I grew up with that, you know, that some of them I still kind of have communications with, but either dead or in jail or drugs, you know, something along those lines, and either selling drugs or using drugs. And it's just, you know, you kind of escape where I'm from. It's like, maybe you do sports or maybe you have this or however it goes. So I ended up moving to Corvallis in high school. Probably, like I said, it saved my life. My mom moved this there. Our house got sold when I was in middle school. She had some family up here, didn't want me to be in trouble. Found life was easier up here. That was my first exposure to seeing, like, white America, you know, like the dominance of white America. I go from a place that's predominantly Black and Hispanic. My high school, predominantly Black and Hispanic. Honestly, white people were the minority in my classes growing up, which is funny to look back on it now. And then going to a school where I'm one of nine Black students in my entire high school. So it was a culture shock, but it definitely prepared me for the real world. So
what were you like in high school?
What was I like in high school? I was an athlete. I was, you know, I played any sport. I played baseball my whole life, basketball, football. I went on for college for sports and football. But I was a I don't want to just say I was a jock, because I wasn't. I really wasn't. I was educated. I mean, in middle school, I was like in GATE. I think you call it TAG here. It's like the gifted and talented educationally. So I was in advanced classes as well. But I hung up. I was always an inclusive person. I didn't care who you were. I didn't care what your status was. Like I told everybody, I treat the janitor like I treat the president. I was real. Like I'd have Hispanic friends that none of the popular people hung out with, you know, or the popular friends or the rich kids and then the poor kids, right? Like to me, it didn't matter. If we got along, we got along. And fortunately, I was able to maneuver through all of these different considerations and environments, which just added so much more diversity and perspective for myself, which allowed me to flourish as I continued to go on in life and explore different places. But yeah, I want to say in high school, I was chill.
And have you always been, you know, social justice oriented, committed to either the Black cause or any cause? Have you always sort of had this, like,
so I'll tell you,
activist advocate type of mentality?
So I'll tell you one of the more, I want to say that the changing points in my life or one of the things that really was instilled in me and really made me look at things differently. Again, I'm in Corvallis High School. I'm one of 9 Black people. I have influence. I'm an athlete. I'm known to some degree. I guess I'm popular. It's a small city that I live in. Well, I ended up getting in trouble. I ended up getting caught shoplifting. I think we've all been there as a young person. Maybe they haven't. Maybe I'm just telling on myself, but it's okay. I'm all right with it. I've done my time. No, I didn't go to jail, but you know, I got in trouble and I ended up having to miss a couple of football games. And so that was big. You know, I had to like end up going through the gauntlet of, you know, you have a future ahead of you, which are right. You know, you got to take
the scared straight, like.
Yeah, I mean,
nobody screamed at you.
Yeah, you know, I mean, most of my coaches were white, so it was just kind of like they were trying to sit me down. I guess I should say I didn't have a father figure growing up. Really, I was raised by all women, and so my mom, my grandmother, and my aunt, and so I didn't really have that presence in my life or that voice for the most part. I did have an uncle. He was significant, or I do have an uncle. I'm gonna say past tense because he's current. I just saw him last week. Shout out Victor, but. I had one coach that was a Black coach. He was working at HP, and he was just helping out. He was from, maybe he's from Alabama or somewhere in the South, Mississippi, somewhere. He went to Tulane. He went to Tulane College. He played football. He played tight end, Coach Charles. And when I got in trouble, you know, Coach Charles set me down. I guess man to man. I was 16, you know, but man to man. And he let me know that, you know, you are the representation of Black people for the people here. However you do, however you interact, however you behave, this is what they view as Black. This is you are that representation here. And I hadn't thought about it that way. I'm still a kid, not a kid, but you know, I'm still a young person without that level of consideration quite yet. And when he told me that, it just stuck with me. It resonated with me. It's like, I got to do better. You know, like, I literally got to do better, because if I'm going to be, I mean, again, I go to a place where they don't even have BET, Black Entertainment Television, right? Like, they really don't have any interaction with Black culture and Black community. I remember having a conversation with a guy, didn't even understand why saying the N-word was a bad thing. Didn't understand that, because talk about Black History Month being glossed over. I think it was only Black History Month in name alone in the high school I went to. I can't recall one thing we ever touched on in high school that was truly in-depth about Black history or anything related to Black history. And we have this conversation, and he's a tough dude. We play football together. We had mutual respect for one another. And I end up having a conversation, just letting him know, like, look, you know I can't stop you from doing anything, but in my presence, out of respect, I appreciate you didn't, because we don't want to have to have these problems, because at that time, I was about that life, you know, already. And so,
did he tell you that you had promised, basically, and you know, not to squander the dream, or to not, you know, like basically telling you, you know, this is a blip or a mistake, but I see you as someone who will go to college. I see you as someone who's doing great things. Was there any of that?
Sorry, my coach. You know, I don't know if it really went that way down the road. I mean, I was pretty competent in my ability, my focus of what I wanted to do. I was always independent person. I worked since I was 16, since I was first allowed to work. I worked, and even before that, I found ways to make money. I used to sell Pokemon cards when I was in middle school. You know, I'd do anything to be independent. And but when I had the interaction with the coach, it was more just like, I think it was more just like a man-to-man, like, you know, you need to hear this. You need this voice to just say, this is what it is. And that really was kind of the, I needed to hear that. You know, it just opened up my perspective, my way of thinking about my environment. So then I was always more aware, cognizant of my environment, how I was reflected. And I usually still am to this day. Like, I know my audience pretty well, right? Like, I know how to go about navigating and behaving under circumstances, how I feel that it's the best reflection of myself if need be. Don't get me wrong, I'm not like an actor or anything. I'm always 100% real, but I'm still very aware pretty much all the time of my audience. And for that to happen, I definitely needed that. It was definitely something that shaped me. But like, I had a, so I started working at this pizza place, American Dream Pizza in Corvallis. Really dope pizza place. I'm one of two high schoolers that worked there. Everybody else is Oregon State students. I mean, it's one of the best that I've ever had. Barack Obama stopped there on his first campaign. I had just left to go to college like 3 months prior, or 3 months after. I was so sad because they all got to meet him and take a picture, and I could have been me. But instead, I had to go off to college and be, you know, smart. And I work at this pizza place. The owner of this pizza place, his name is Mark O'Brien. He becomes probably my first mentor. He's a white guy, but he's from California as well. So I think it's different. I think it's a little different. But he was cool. I was good at football. I got some articles up, so like, we made some noise out there. You put it like on the thing that you had to do, like the little screens to clock in. You have to read my articles before you could even clock in for shift sometime. So it was cool. But he was dope. He was the first person I kind of really got a relationship with that owned their own business. And being in school, when you worked, you had the opportunity to earn a credit just for working if you did some like research and things of that nature. And so then I started learning about like CEOs and business owners and things of that nature. And Mark was cool because he was just willing to give me what kind of insight or leniency or things I needed to kind of accomplish certain things that I wanted to accomplish, like even just a person in a position that I hadn't known previously. And I'll never forget what Mark told me, because I remember as I'm getting ready to go to college or getting ready to strive for greatness, I used to come out and come back as well after I left to go to college. I left immediately, by the way. I was like, I'm getting out of Oregon as soon as possible. It's way too cold and gloomy here, right? And so I ended up going to Arizona State. But prior to me leaving, I'm talking to Mark, and I was like, Mark, you know, I'm gonna be like you when I grow up, you know. I might even be better, Mark, because, you know, I aim high, right? And then Mark, Mark is kind of a dick now you think about it, but Mark is cool. And Mark is just kind of like, oh, so you want to be able to retire by the age of 31? Okay. I'm like, I didn't think about it like that, Mark, but now I'm trying to retire by age of 29. All right, Mark, I'm going to one-up you or something of that nature. And though, obviously, that did not happen for me, it was still cool because it gave me something to strive for. And then he ended up becoming a mentor. At one point, I thought I would go into politics after I finished business, and he was on the city council. He got a seat, and he let me come sit in on meetings and things of that nature. So I would say more in terms of just like a inspirational, like something that, I mean, I always had it in myself. I'm a driven person. Things that, you know, even on the, in terms of, I guess, when you had asked the question, was I always driven by this activism, or to have that in me, or was that taught to me? I'd always, in my life, I knew that after I got to see the world and see more of what America really was, the reflection of America, how it wasn't just this isolated Bay Area type perspective where it is a lot of black people, but more so it's predominantly white. I've been proud to be of where I'm from and what I've been able to make of myself and where I come from. And I always knew that whatever I did in life, I wanted to be able to give back to my community and the people that raised me and the culture and the society that's given so much to me. And what I mean by that is the Black culture, because I mean, I love Black culture. I mean, I just do. I love being a part of it. I love embracing it. You know, I wouldn't trade it for the world. And so I always wanted to be able to give back. And I thought I would do it in different ways. But, you know, when the opportunity in this regard presented itself, it turned out well. But in terms of like an activism, even before the Black Excellence, I mean, I've been out here marching since 2015, since I first arrived. I've been upset, you know, like I feel the pain and the frustration that a lot of us have to endure. You know, some people can, you know, people of other descents, other cultures and community can look past it, cannot be affected and not feel it. But I had a conversation with my mom today, and even she's like, you know, oh, I'm 60 years old, and she's scared to be pulled over by the police. And I'm like, jeez, it's terrible. You know, that's terrible. But that's really the reality that we have to own and live in at all times. And it's like brings tension to my body just thinking about it. But, you know.
Well, and you said you've been marching since 2015, and I know that the march has gone on, you know, since the 60s, if not before. When you were marching this past summer, you know, after George Floyd, do you think that things are changing? Do you see hope? Do you see, and I know it could be hope with skepticism, but with the Black Lives Matter movement and with the developments that we're experiencing right now, do you see brighter days? Where are you at with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard because I don't know. I try to be optimistic. I really do. But you just see so much of the same, right? And you would think, I mean, you would think after what's transpired this past summer that, well, now everybody's aware. It's clearly not just in these people's heads, or they're imagining these indifferences or these inequalities, these injustices, right? We can visually perceive it. Everybody's aware. Everybody's at the highest notice. I mean, like we marched for over 100 days here in Portland, right?
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt, but why do you think it was George Floyd that did that? Like, why wasn't Tamir Rice, you know, kid in a park with a fake toy gun, shot to death? Like, why were none of any of these other sort of
these instances?
Why didn't they prompt outrage?
You know, I think it was, in my opinion, hearing him cry, especially out to his dead mother. I think that just resonates with a lot of people. Like hearing a grown man, like first of all, I really never heard a grown man cry like that, and especially a grown Black man, like to really cry like in that way. I mean, it was eerie to me. It was eerie for me to hear it. Like, I've seen this happen. Mm-hmm. I myself fight to not be desensitized by it. Right. Like, it's like, again, another one. Right. You know, like that's almost where I'm at with it, even though it still hurts every time. But it's just the cycle is so perpetual. Like, I'm just.
So that's what it took, is seeing on the street someone on top of someone's neck crying for their mom.
Right. That casualness.
That could not breathe.
Yeah, and I think there was the whole scene and like the casualness that the cop just murdered this person, like without any remorse for it, and just,
you know, with just, other cops
with
there.
The other cops present, and it's just like there's nothing, you know, a lot of people in the past had always tried to, oh, well, if you did this, or if they just did that, or if they weren't resisting, mm-hmm. or it's always so.
Oh, I see what you mean. Like, oh, they were on the run, or they.
Yeah.
And so here you have someone who clearly is on the ground. I mean, you could have tased him. You could have done anything. You could have, when he said he couldn't breathe, believed him.
Right.
But nothing, no matter what you do, is deserving of someone on your neck. So it sounds like because of that, the display, the visual, and the emotive vocals and the crying, that sort of resonated with people who maybe before thought, oh, that's not me, or, you know, I'm not worried about that. So there was a stroke of humanity, I guess, that
Absolutely.
Arose.
Well, because we all have mothers, right? Everybody that's here has a mother, and you know what it takes. I think you feel you could resonate with that to cry out to your mother. I mean, I can't remember the last time I cried out to my mother. I had to be a child, you know, like a literal, like 4 or 5-year-old person. So to see that level of distress and concern and discern, I think.
And I hear that. I just don't get, you know, I mentioned Tamir Rice. I think of Sandra Bland. I think of all these people. I'm like, did none of these things resonate with you?
Well, maybe you can't resonate with, you know, a little black kid, you know, for whatever reason, or a black woman for whatever reason that you can't. But we all got mothers. I mean,
Or what you're saying, too, is they, you know, not just the running, but they put something on it. So, like, oh, Eric Gardner, he was selling outside of a store. Right. He asked for it, or he had it coming.
Right.
You know, which is what people do with assault victims as well. Like, right. they put themselves in that position. And that's what they deserve. So maybe that's it as well, is that somehow all these other things, people who changed in this instance could give that other excuse, but in this excuse they could not find something. This is a man who, what could he be doing that would cause him to be on the street in this fashion?
Right. I mean, I think it was like the tipping point, right? Like, you had, it had built up this momentum, and maybe you were there, you know, it wasn't like it was, this is the first time that white people were involved, but I think it was just the straw that broke the camel's back, and that one consideration, like, in with all those circumstances involved, it just was like, it was like this explosion. It was like the perfect storm almost to just be like, all right, this is messed up. Because it wasn't even just like it was America, you know what I mean? There are, what, 19, 20 countries around the world from that point on.
Yeah.
I mean, I had friends from all around the world that were, you know, showing, you know, marches, or, you know, showing protests. How can I get a Black Lives Matter shirt? What can I do to help? And these people, this isn't even a problem. You know, these people are halfway across the world, yeah, or all the way around the world. And they're like, what is happening in America? Why can't you fix this?
It also seemed like people realized, because before the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, I think people wrote it off as like a fringe of, you guys do that. Whereas people didn't realize that, no, this is for everybody. This is what it really means. And that's an interesting conversation, where there are people still to this day that, you know, you say Black Lives Matter, they say Cops Lives Matter. You say Black Lives Matter, they say everyone matters.
Right.
And
Blue Lives Matter.
They don't understand that, okay, it is not your type of person who's getting shot at, who can't drive, who can't go to a store, who has to worry about their children getting, you know, shot on the street corner. So, and the analogy is, I mean, there's tons of them. Like, if there's a forest in the, if there's a fire in the Amazon forest, at that moment, the Amazon forest matters. You can collectively care about everybody and everything, but you must care about the most urgent and the most pressing. And I'm sort of sickened when people do that, where they're like, oh, well, what about this? What about that? What about these lives? And it's sort of like, and it's kind of what we talked about before, about the social contract of America. I don't give a shit if you're not black. You should care about black people, and you should care about them getting shot.
Right.
And so if you're not, who are you? Who are you as a Judeo-Christian? Who are you as a good American? Who are you as someone who lives in a collective society?
Right. As a person.
As a person. Yeah. Yeah. And so that's interesting. And that maybe is part of the change. And again, cautiously optimistic, right? Of maybe the change is that people now see that it's not just a black movement for black people. It's a movement for all Americans, or all people across the world, who realize that they have a heart, that they, that a child's a child, that a mother loses, you know, like, that there's humanity in these things, that it's not, because it's not going to happen to me, that I don't have to care about it.
Right.
Which is a privileged but a heartless response.
Right. Well, my only thing is, and where this is where I err on the caution of getting too, you know, too optimistic, is, are we just in a guilt reflection moment? Like, is this just a moment in time where white America, or people that, you know, can't relate and haven't had this this occur in their demographic and their society or their culture, or their family, and, you know, are they just at this level of guilt that it's like, mm-hmm, all right, this is this time, and then there's this moment, and then things just move on, you know?
Yeah.
or is there really some change that's going to come about? Like, what do we come of this, and you know, what comes of this moment in time? Like, how is it? How do you bottle this and move it to the next phase of what can we get to make this better, make this situation different than the last time, so we don't repeat this next year or in 2 years or in 5 years? Because for me personally, that's the hardest thing. It's that we go through these extreme moments of, you know, marching or reflection or donations or however it looks, and then, you know, it starts to downplay a little bit, kind of like you see in it right now. It's like flattening it out, right? We're at this peak, and now it's starting to flatten back out. And then when it flattens out and it's not the topic of, you know, it's not the topic of consideration anymore, if it's not popular anymore, then what happens? Is there any reform that's done? Is there any things that are really taking place to say that we're going to make this not happen again? And the reason I asked that question is because I think I just saw an instance, what, like 2 days ago, I believe it was a black man who was having a mental health crisis, and the cops were called to his house.
He was naked in the street, right?
I don't even know if he was naked in the street. I think he was just in his front lawn. I think he was in his front lawn, his family, because his family are at the door. I'm watching the video, and they're like, "Don't shoot him! Don't shoot him! Like, please don't shoot him!" They're acting, and you know, they're casually saying it. And the cop has no reason. This guy isn't threatening. He's not doing anything. Maybe he is.
Well,
naked.
I think his mom told them that he had a mental health issue.
Right.
You know, and that's a whole other thing of the, you know, not just the prison industrial complex. The idea that, you know, you see a black man outside and you're calling six cop cars where someone might need a social worker.
Sure.
They might need health care. They may need, you know,
anything but the cop interaction. And then the other hard part about that is too, is that, you know, again, where I find that this could be most effective and how change could really come in from this, if there was some accountability that was held, if there were something that, you know, either some punishment or some legal ramifications that said, hey, if you're killing these people unjustifiably, you're held to some consequences.
But, and that's a whole other issue of like police immunity and police departments, where the whole entire department's corrupt. You know, they literally will come back that day and say, how many black people did you arrest?
Right.
Like, it's a quota. It's a fun game for who they find, who they arrest, or this sort of groupthink of, you know, if this person is during an assault, you know, or during an arrest, assaulting a black person, I'm going to go along with that because that's what my department does. No, that doesn't mean you have to go. So there's got to be like internal reporting. There's got to be potentially, you know, and the whole defund police thing, which is a whole other issue of people misinterpreting that. You know, how about on a police department having someone who is culturally competent and knows about the community and is a community liaison?
Right.
How about having a community policing board? I think they're going to be starting that here, where you actually have people who are involved in that community telling the police department what they want to see in the policing and having that communication. So yeah, you're absolutely right of there's got to be systematic change and not just posting Black Lives Matter, or like with Martin Luther King, you know, we at my law firm, we posted a quote, but I like to think we're also doing work,
right?
You know, so the idea, though, in this sort of white savior performance allyship, that you can read a book and post a quote and then, or go to a racial training, and then you're good for the year.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of that I'm seeing, and that sort of makes me, it makes me disgusted, because that does not address, have you reflected on your implicit biases?
Right.
Have you looked at your organizational structure? Do you have representation on your team? What are you doing for the community? You know, like, those are the things that are actually real.
Right.
Because anybody can share a quote. And so if you're sharing a quote and you're doing the work, that's a little bit different. So I do see that. And, you know, of course, there's black appropriation as well, making money off of black people during a time when black people are in the media.
Right.
You know, selling things to black people from people who are white, basically putting out in a way to the public believes that it's a black company, or that they have that person or that group's permission. I'm kind of where you're at in the sense of, and I don't know either. I like to think that things can get better. I'm probably a realist and an optimist.
Yeah, I was saying.
But I'm not. I'm also skeptical.
Yeah.
And, but I do know lately that in a sea of really shitty people that are horrible, I mean, I hate saying that, but there's really shitty, horrible people.
Mm-hmm.
There are a sea of really beautiful, hardworking people that care about America, that care about civil rights, that really do want to change and really do want to have those tough conversations, not just the superficial ones.
Sure. And I agree, you know, and some of those conversations where I say I'm explaining some of the things, and this is why I say there are good white people out there, and though I'm a humanitarian by nature, I really am, like, for the overall good of humanity, I want to do things, I want to be a part of the change that I, you know, strive to see, right? And therefore, I don't mind sharing thought and sharing, you know, something of consideration for a person that really wants to embrace it and digest it, not just dispute it or, you know, go against it, defend it. But, you know, as I am a humanitarian, I'm also, sadly, I do lose faith in humanity at times, you know, just some of the instances where it's just, you just see so much selfishness out there and so much unwillingness to change or adapt or to give a little, right? Like you said, people are fearful of losing things and this mine, and give me my thoughts and just me, this me reflective state. And for me, it's just kind of hard. Like, can you change that thought? Can you change that mentality on a large scale? Is that possible? Is that realistic? Like, if we're talking about, you know, realistic optimism, right? Being a realist and an optimist at the same time. It's like, oh, it's great when I have a conversation with Jonas, Michael, you know, it's great when I have, you know, these conversations with the people that are open-minded enough to hear me out or digest something different. But what about the other portion of the population that isn't there?
And some of them are people in power. And that's the thing that we have to face is we have people who normalize hate and are complicit with racism, who are mayors and governors and congressmen and women.
Former presidents,
CEOs of companies. So that's the really interesting thing.
Yeah.
Is it's become, as we've said, so normalized. But I think that's all you can do is be cautiously optimistic or be, what'd you call it, a realist and an optimist or realistic optimism. That's all you can do because you don't want to have that gloss over, but you also don't want to believe that it can't happen. Because the history of the nation is a really dark history, but it is a history of growth and progress as well.
Yep.
What I wanted to ask you is about, you know, your organization. It's called PDX Black Excellence. What is Black Excellence? So if I say to you, you know, what do you think Black Excellence is?
I think Black Excellence is just a representation of our dope culture. Like, you know, the reason that we embody everything that's Black in the city, whether it be events that are happening, whether it be people that are selling things, whether it be initiatives, whatever it's happening, like, we embody this Black reality that, you know, we're dope, you know, and we support one another, right? And so for us, it's kind of like this, you know, there's just this umbrella of connectivity. It's a popularized phrase, but in reality, it's like, well, we're in this together, and like, we are excellent. We really are. And so I think that in terms of the way I view it, you know, it's just you know, an acknowledgement of us, you know, acknowledgement of what we accomplish, what we can do, what we strive to be, who we are as a community, what we bring to the table together collectively, individually. But it's just an embodiment of, in my opinion, everything that's Black and everything that's dope, which is the two go hand in hand.
And where do you see your organization going, you know, in the future?
Yeah, so we just transitioned to a nonprofit at the beginning of the year, and so that was one of the bigger things that came from COVID. Before I said, like I said, we were more based in event management, and during COVID, we became like a resource place. Like, how can we find resources and help get resources to the people in need? So now going forward, some of our initiatives are already aligned with how we can benefit, especially our culture, but also, you know, just the diverse culture people that come from unprivileged or unrepresented, you know, those kind of representation of people. And so we want to do initiatives such as, like, we have financial literacy coming up for the youth, where we're going to be working with middle schoolers and high schoolers. Again, this representation of people that don't have these understandings, don't have access and opportunity to these kind of resources and thinking. I was one of those kids, so I know what it's like. We want to do mental health awareness. We started with wanting to do mental health awareness. You might not know, but just tattoo the semicolon, but I'm clinical depression and anxiety. So I was diagnosed with anxiety and depression, I think 2014 or 13. And so to me, it's important because as a Black man navigating through that, I had to do it a lot on my own. And we should say we're reluctant to vulnerability for the most part. Growing up, you have to be strong. You have to be tough because the world is hard for a lot of us, right? It's not an easy pat on the back or easy ride for us. So to accept this level of vulnerability, it's like, well, either I'm weak or there's something wrong with me and you don't want to acknowledge it. In reality, a lot of people have these issues. And we just happen to be people that go untreated, undiagnosed, unexposed to resources that can help us. And so for me, it's important to spread that narrative that it's okay to have these issues and to find the right help and resources and need, and just lead that by being an example of somebody that's gone through it. But as we started to talk, we realized that with other health professionals that there's physical things, and I'm being one of them, that we're just not aware of because we don't have that passed down to us. We don't know how to go and check on certain things. We don't know what things we need to be checking on. So we want to do like a health conference, a weekend of mental health, physical health considerations, having that come from a Black voice, people that people can relate to, especially young people. We have a young people target audience. We're doing a lot of collaborations coming up, a lot of partnerships. So we just started a partnership with Oregon State and my former alma mater. It's dope because I graduated from the business school and now I'm doing business with my school that I graduated from. So I think that's pretty cool. We're engaging in partnerships and collaborations going forward that are going to allow us to really, I think, do a lot of good and get a lot of exposure to people that need the kind of exposure that they might not get under other circumstances or other considerations. We just want to keep being a resource. The end of the summer, we wrapped up. We did a quick 10-day turnaround fundraiser. We did a raffle, and we were able to raise $2,000 in a week and get for families $500 and help for the holidays and COVID. So we plan on expanding on that and really becoming resources. Prior to during COVID, we had some deals or things in place that didn't work out, but we were trying to get money and resources, like financial resources, to Black-owned businesses that literally closed down during the pandemic. And we were in, talks and things of that, because that didn't pan out. But that's what we want to do. We want to become a resource, one, a resource of connectivity. We want to become a place where you can also, like, we're two-part. So we want to be this resource. We still want to do these events and put things in the community that people can gravitate towards, learn from, like educational type things, and just other opportunities where you might not have been able to do it previously. But we also want to become, the hub for what's going on Black in Portland. And maybe that transitions to other places in the future. But we want to make that transitional gap between whether you being a transplant or a local to be able to connect with your community, and not just, Black Portland, but advocates or people that want to be engaged with diversity here or in other places. Like, here's this place where you can do it. Here's this place where you can find it. Here's this all-inclusive kind of hub where no matter where you're from, no matter where you're at currently, you can find this connection to this culture and this community right here. And I think as going forward, we want to expand that out and make that look a few different ways. So we'll save that for another chat. But but yeah, we got some aspirations.
I think all of that is excellent. And thank you for doing work in our community. And of course, let me know how I can help in that way. Yeah. We have 5 questions to ask you, which are the 5 podcast questions I ask every guest.
Let's do it.
So the first one is, if this wasn't your focus right now, what would be your passion project?
If this wasn't my focus right now, what would be my passion project? You know, my passion in life is just travel. I just love travel. I love exposure and providing exposure to different people around the world. So I'm not sure how it would pan out, but it would have to be something related. Like, I almost went to go teach English as a second language just to get exposure to myself, but expose myself to others. So something related to travel and just, again, trying to spread this, like, just this opportunity to connect with different people in different walks of life, because then they get that experience and I get that experience. And I think overall it helps the experience for everybody.
Cool. And what is something in your life, other than your given or chosen family, that you know will always bring you some sort of joy?
Yeah, I mean, I could also say travel, but that's a good question. I really am a people person, so that's just hard for me to because I am so. I value the people that are in my life so much. Like, they keep my drive for a lot of reasons. You know, like I said, relating back to depression, anxiety issues, is just like, without the people that were there, that were my foundation in my life to keep that drive, I don't know where I'd be. But I mean, that's probably another travel response, but I really do love people. That's a hard one for me to disconnect from.
Yeah, no, that's a great answer. What are you binge watching or reading right now?
Binge watching or reading. So I'm binge watching again for about the 18th time, The Wire, because The Wire is the dopest show of all time, first and foremost. That's probably one of my most influential anything. The Wire put me up on politics to begin with. Like, I know nothing about what was happening behind the scenes before I watched The Wire. So anybody out there that's listening, if you ain't seen The Wire yet, check it out, because The Wire is so dope. But yes, I'm rewatching The Wire. I'm in season 3 right now again, and I'm reading the Trevor Noah story, Born a Life of Crime, I think is the title of it, which is a really great book as well. I highly recommend that as well.
Yeah, I like Trevor Noah.
Trevor Noah's dope.
When the world gets back to normal, whatever that means, and this is funny because this is a question for you, where would you like to travel first?
Yeah, man, there's so many. But I don't have to shout out my people in Germany. I mean, I owe them a visit. I got so many close friends out there, and I'm long overdue for being there. And honestly, of all the European cities that I've been to, if I had to pick up in, well, I still love Denmark. I do love Denmark. I was thinking about maybe I need an anchor baby mother in Denmark. I don't know if that's going to work out. But Berlin is my city. I really love Berlin, so I'd probably say Germany.
Very cool. If you were asked to give a TED Talk, what would your talk be about?
Ooh, these are the good questions. Let's see. If I were asked to give a TED Talk, what would the TED Talk be? And I still think with my ingenious idea of kind of America without black people, I think that's kind of a route that I would go. It'd just be like, yeah, Let's break down all of the infrastructures and considerations about, like, what our society, what America as we know it today looks like with the removal of black people from consideration. I just think that'd be a really cool, interesting topic to look at. I don't think anybody really considers it on that level, but it really is very influential.
And yeah, it sounds like that's something you need to start working on.
I'm saying, Mike, you ready to write the script with me? You ready?
Who are 2 or more of your favorite local organizations that are doing great things in the community? So who do you want to give a shout out to?
Yeah, so off the rip, I got to go with Simple X, my man Yosef and Wilson over at Simple X. If you're not familiar, they do outstanding work in the community with these incredible conversations, Simple X mixers, Simple X stories. I mean, they're my favorite experiences in the city outside of our own. I mean, they brought some real big shots to the table to just pick their brain, like some, you know, people that you wouldn't normally have the opportunity to engage with on this kind of personable level. And they just do a fantastic job with it. I know they got a summit coming up next month, or no, in March. And so anybody, check out, look out Simple X. They are the ones. And then I definitely got to give a shout out to my man Lakiana at Word is Bond. So if you're not familiar with Word is Bond, they're another great nonprofit organization here in the community, helping literally connect kids, black kids, with the police, trying to help bridge that gap to understanding and, you know, sensitivity training and things of that nature. So they're doing some really good work. I highly recommend people take a look at them, donate to them, because it's much needed work that they're doing in the community, and I have a lot of respect and appreciation for them.
Yeah, those are both great shout outs. How can people find you? So do you have an Instagram, and what can people do to help you?
Yeah, so you can find us at, you can find us pretty much anywhere at PDX Black Excellence, either on Instagram. You can go to pdxblackexcellence.com and check out what we're doing there. We're developing it, the website, every day. Please, I urge you, go subscribe to our newsletter. We're rolling out a lot of really good content, and we got more to come, and I highly encourage people to stay connected with us that way. And like I said, we've become a nonprofit, so, you know, feel free to donate to us as well. We got a lot of really cool initiatives coming up that we, you know, we're eager to get involved with, and we're going to need some help and some support, so, you know, help us out. But yeah, Facebook, some other things coming up, Michael. I'm gonna have to like give you another something else at the end of this when we wrap up some things.
You can come back.
Hey, yeah. I'll come back and we'll talk about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I really appreciate you doing the podcast, and I appreciate our conversation. And I certainly appreciate the work that you're doing in the community. I know it's not easy. This is tough work. So thank you.
Thank you for having me. It's tough work, but it's gratifying. You know, like we me and Kayla, we work around the clock. Like we'll get out of here and go straight back to it. You know, like, and we're building something, but we're proud of it. We're happy to be doing it. So even though there's, you know, inconsiderable amount of hours that we have to put in to keep it going, you know, we're happy to do it because it's meaningful, it's impactful. And people appreciate and find value in it. So we want to continue to service our community that way and be, you know, that positive change that we seek and that we desire in the world. So if this is the way I can do it and give to it, then I'm all for it.
Well, thank you so much.
We want to thank Raylan Jones for being on this episode of the podcast. Be sure to visit pdxblackexcellence.com. PDX Black Excellence is a community organization, cultural movement, to connect and support Portland's Black residents and advocates. Again, we want to extend a sincere thank you to X-Ray FM for the 2020 X-Ray Award. Check out all the good work they're doing at 91.1 FM, 107.1 FM, and online at xray.fm. And thank you for checking out this episode of All of Your Business. You can visit us at allofyourbusinesspodcast.com for previous episodes, sponsors, and much more. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast and share with your friends. This episode was recorded at JJT Studios and edited at Track 11 Music.